Welcome to Learning English, the 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Brian Lynn. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower than normal. We also explain words and expressions, all while helping you learn more about the United States and the world. Today, correspondent Pete Musto will bring us part two of his higher education series report on online degree programs. Then you will hear words and their stories. Ana Mateo will take us outside to explain American English expressions related to rain. And as we do each week, we will end with the making of a nation. This week, Steve Ember takes a look at the second term of Bill Clinton, the 42nd President of the United States. We begin with Pete Musto.
Last week, we talked about Americans taking college classes and completing study programs online, that is, with the help of computers and over the internet. The United States Department of Education has noted the growing popularity of online degree programs, what it called distance education. It reported that 14% of all students at American colleges and universities studied through such programs in 2014. Leanne is one of those students. Her goal was to earn a master's degree in nursing from George Washington University in Washington, D.C. She signed up for the university's online program in 2014. She asked VOA not to share her last name because she has yet to complete her studies. Leanne chose to study online for many of the same reasons that other students do. She was working full-time and did not want to move away from her job and family to continue her education. Leanne liked that she was able to study whenever and however much she wanted. But while the program met her needs at first, Leanne feels there are things she did not get from studying online. She earned her undergraduate degree from a traditional face-to-face study program at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Leanne says physically being in a classroom helps build a strong connection between students and their professors. She says in some ways she liked taking control and leading her own studies. But many times, she also felt lost without that special connection.
In the end, there's really no substitute for the exchanges that actually happen in a classroom. And I think that, to some extent, I missed out on that, and I would have liked to have had that experience.
In addition, it may not be just a student's learning that suffers in a distance learning program. There is some concern about what future employers think about an online degree. Public Agenda is a nonprofit research organization in the United States. In 2013, the group reported on a study of over 600 people working for American companies. They were responsible for filling positions at these businesses. The study looked at what these employment specialists thought about online degree programs. 56% said they were more likely to offer jobs to people with a more traditional college experience, where students and teachers meet face-to-face. 42% said they thought students in online programs learned less than those in traditional programs. And 39% of those questioned said they thought online programs were easier to complete. Allison Cadleck is a senior vice president of Public Agenda. She says the numbers may have changed a little over the past 4 years as online programs become more popular, but there are still strong critical opinions about what online programs can do for students.
There is a kind of traditional bias about what education should be, and technology and life and work and everything show what's problematic about that hundreds-year-old model of education. But it's still something that's so ingrained in who we are and how we think about higher education.
There appears to be a barrier for online programs becoming more widely accepted. If more well-known, high-quality schools start offering such programs, employers will likely consider the two methods as equal. But the high cost to create high-quality online programs suggests this will not be easy. The WICHE Cooperative for Educational Technologies studies online learning. The group released a study on the cost of creating online programs in February. It asked administrators at 197 colleges to report on the costs of 21 different components needed to operate the two programs. This included the cost of paying professors to design materials and testing. At all the colleges, administrators noted that 9 of the components generally cost more than for traditional programs. 12 of the components cost about the same. Nothing in any online program cost less. Russ Poulin helped create the study. He says the reason costs are so high for online programs is all the extra steps they require. In a traditional program, the main cost is the professor, who designs the study materials, and the building where the class is taught. But if many professors take turns teaching in the same rooms, the cost of the building is shared by all the students in those classes. The study found that costs for students in online programs were lower at only about 6% of the schools. And Poulin adds that schools cannot simply pass these costs on to students.
We really have reached a point, whether it's distance education or in the face-to-face education, where you can raise the price to the student so long that they're able to absorb it up to a point. And really, we're starting to hear the pain being expressed by the students in terms of they can't pay back loans or they can't afford even to come in.
Poulin and Cadleck agree that as technology changes and becomes less costly, some of these problems may solve themselves. More students are choosing online college programs over traditional programs every year. But there is still a ways to go before online and traditional programs operate on the same level. I'm Pete Musto.
And now, it's time for the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. In some parts of the world, April is a time of thunderstorms and lots of rain. In the U.S., we even have a rhyme to describe it. April showers bring May flowers. This rhyme does not simply describe a weather event. It reminds us that even something bad or inconvenient, in this case rain, can bring something good, in this case flowers. We will talk about flower expressions another time. Today, let's talk about rain. Even though rain is necessary for nature, many expressions use rain to represent troubles, loneliness, or hard times. To rain on someone's parade is to question their positive attitude or to ruin their good time. Someone who rains on another person's parade is usually trying to introduce a note of caution or practical advice. This person may not mean to make the other person feel bad, but raining on someone's parade can really kill a good mood. By the way, this is a fixed expression, so you shouldn't say, "Don't rain on my picnic," or "Don't rain on my baseball game." People will have no idea what you're talking about. In the musical Funny Girl, Barbara Streisand's character just wants to live her life in her way. She doesn't want others to stop her from trying to achieve her dreams. So she warns people, "Don't rain on my parade." Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. Don't tell me not to fly. I simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Who told you you're allowed to rain on my parade? No one has a perfectly happy life all the time. A poetic way to express that thought is to say, "Into each life, a little rain must fall." Here is singer Ella Fitzgerald complaining that she is getting more than her fair share of suffering. Into each life, some rain must fall, but too much is falling in my. When it rains, it pours, is another popular expression. This means when one bad thing happens, many other things often follow. Now, there isn't any science to support this. Perhaps it just feels that way when it's happening to you. This is too good of an expression not to be in a country song. Merle Haggard uses it this way. When it rains, it pours, and it all seems so sad. Before it's over, it will wash away all I had. Some people are so happy, so excited, or so in love that they don't let anything, including the weather, stop them from doing something. Come rain or come shine means you are not going to let anything stop you. Sometimes rain does affect your plans. Let's say you plan a big outdoor party for all your friends. Unfortunately, on the day of the party, it rains cats and dogs. In other words, it rains really heavily. You will have to reschedule. Your guests can take a rain check and come back another time. Rain check comes from the early days of baseball. If a baseball game was canceled because of rain, attendees were given a piece of paper, a rain check, allowing them to come back on a different day to see the game. So, when you take a rain check on something, you will have to wait before you can do it. In comparison, when you save something for a rainy day, you choose to put it safely away for future use. Usually, we use this expression for saving money. But you can save anything for a rainy day. Up until now, all these rain expressions use the wet weather as a hardship, sadness, inconvenience, or difficulty that a person must overcome. One exception is the expression, right as rain. If something is right as rain, it is perfectly fine. For example, let's say you hurt your back playing sports. You could tell your friends not to worry and that you'll be right as rain in a week or two. Some word experts say that rain is used in this expression simply for its R sound. Right and rain sound good together. And that brings us to the end of this program. But come rain or shine, we will be back next week with another Words and Their Stories. Let us know if you have any rain expressions in your language in the comment section. I'm Ana Mateo.
Now we present The Making of a Nation.
This week in our series, we look back at Bill Clinton's second term as president.
For 4 years now, to realize our vision, we have pursued a simple but profound strategy. Opportunity for all. Responsibility from all. A strong, united American community.
Americans elected Clinton as their 42nd president in 1992 and re-elected him 4 years later. In the summer of 1996, President Clinton's first term was coming to an end. He had established a mixed record of successes and failures in his dealings with Congress. He had greater difficulty in those dealings after opposition Republicans won control of Congress in 1994. All presidents face political battles, but in President Clinton's case, there was more to it. He and his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, were being investigated over their personal financial dealings in Arkansas during the 1980s. There were also accusations of womanizing from his years as governor of that state. But in the summer of 96, President Clinton's public approval ratings stayed above 50% and went as high as 60%. The economy had improved during his first term. Americans were getting jobs and spending more money. In August of 1996, the Democratic Party met in Chicago and nominated President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore for a second term.
My fellow Democrats and my fellow Americans, thank you for your nomination. I don't know if I can find a fancy way to say this, but I accept.
The Republican Party held its nominating convention that summer in San Diego, California. The party chose former Kansas Senator Bob Dole as its presidential candidate. He had resigned from the United States Senate to seek the nomination. He chose former Congressman and Cabinet Secretary Jack Kemp of New York as his vice presidential running mate. Dole was a World War II hero who suffered a permanent injury to his right arm. He later served four terms in the House of Representatives. He was elected to the Senate in 1968 and re-elected four times. Another candidate in the presidential race was businessman Ross Perot. He won the nomination of the Reform Party, which he started a year earlier. He had also run for president in 1992 and received 19% of the popular vote. During the 96 campaign, President Clinton pointed to the stronger economy. He also campaigned on his legislative record, including new gun control measures and a higher minimum wage for the lowest paid workers. Bob Dole, in his campaign, accused President Clinton of spending too much. Clinton's answer was that he had stopped Congress from cutting too much from programs like health insurance for retirees. Bill Clinton and Al Gore easily won the election, defeating Bob Dole and Jack Kemp. Ross Perot received just 8% of the popular vote this time. Clinton became the first Democrat to win a second term since Franklin Roosevelt in 1936. William Jefferson Clinton began his second term as President of the United States on January 20, 1997. His inaugural speech would be the last by an American president in the 20th century.
Let us lift our eyes toward the challenges that await us in the next century. It is our great good fortune that time and chance have put us not only at the edge of a new century in a new millennium, but on the edge of a bright new prospect in human affairs, a moment that will define our course and our character for decades to come. We must keep our old democracy forever young.
During his first term, President Clinton appointed a large number of women and minorities to the government. As he began his second term, he chose the first woman to serve as Secretary of State. Madeleine Albright had represented the United States in the United Nations during Clinton's first term. And he appointed the first Asian American to serve in the cabinet. Norman Mineta became Secretary of Commerce. The Republican Party kept control of both houses of Congress in the 1996 elections. At the end of his first term, Clinton had gotten into a budget fight with the Republicans, which resulted in two government shutdowns. Those shutdowns did more political harm to the Republicans than to the president. In 1997, they reached a compromise. They agreed to a plan to end the federal deficit by 2002. In fact, the budget was balanced much sooner. In 1998, the economy was so strong that the government found itself with an extra $70 billion, the first surplus since 1969. President Clinton visited China in 1998. He spoke of his belief that in the 21st century, democracy will be the right course practically as well as morally, yielding more stability and more progress. A month later, in August of 1998, Al-Qaeda terrorists bombed the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The attacks killed more than 200 people. President Clinton ordered missile strikes against Al-Qaeda targets in Sudan and in Afghanistan in an effort to kill the group's leader, Osama bin Laden. Later in the year, President Clinton ordered military action in response to Iraq's refusal to cooperate with United Nations inspectors. The inspectors were searching for nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Clinton ordered missile strikes against targets that UN officials said could have been linked to such weapons of mass destruction. In 1999, Clinton deployed American aircraft and missiles as part of a NATO campaign in Yugoslavia. NATO was trying to stop attacks against ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. Yugoslav military leaders agreed to withdraw their troops. NATO stopped the bombing and sent an international peacekeeping force to Kosovo. Earlier in Clinton's presidency, the United States had led NATO airstrikes against Serb targets in the former Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia. The operations followed the killing of 8,000 Muslim men and boys by Bosnian Serb forces in Srebrenica, a UN-declared safe area. Clinton later pushed for the 1995 peace agreement to end the Bosnian War. 3 years later, in 1998, Israeli and Palestinian leaders signed a memorandum of understanding at the White House. It called for Israeli forces to withdraw from some areas of the West Bank. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Special Diplomat Dennis Ross traveled repeatedly to the Middle East to work on the peace efforts. In 2001, President Clinton tried to get Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak to sign a peace agreement. Clinton invited the two leaders to the United States and held many hours of talks with them. Reports said they came close to an agreement, but the negotiations ended without success. Palestinians declared a new uprising against Israel. On trade issues, President Clinton, at the end of his second term, got Congress to approve permanent normal trade relations with China. Clinton argued that the move would create a better environment for democratic reforms in China, as well as creating jobs in the United States. Among other foreign policy matters during his presidency, Clinton normalized relations with Vietnam, and he supported the expansion of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, in Europe.
Bill Clinton's presidency will be remembered, at least in part, for his efforts to reach out to the international community. But it will also be remembered for the impeachment trial in Congress that almost ended his presidency. That will be our story on next week's The Making of a Nation. That's all the time we have for today's show. Listen again tomorrow for more programs designed to teach English while bringing you stories from around the world. I'm Brian Lind.